Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And now let's get started. So a very warm welcome to the star of this particular show. It's Reading FC legend Dylan Kerr. So Dylan, how are you?
I'm very, very well. Can't believe it's 28 degrees in sunny Mexborough. It's the first time I've been home when it's actually not pishing down with rain and blowing a northeasterly off the east coast. So no, it's good. It's good.
Yeah. Well, it's like the weather in South Africa, isn't it? And you came back on Monday, didn't you?
I came back on Monday. I came back for a reason, to sort all my personal stuff out and try and you know, get my life in order, because it's been on standstill for 3 years.
Yeah.
I'm only back for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And the last 2 days I've been putting all my life in bits and bobs together, and today I put half of it in storage. Tomorrow I'm going to put the rest of it in storage. And that's all my Reading memorabilia. Today, Mark, honestly, I have got my man of the matches from, you know, from two seasons at Reading, and and they're still in mint condition. All the crystal glasses and my player of the year, Cantalabra, was brilliant.
Yeah, excellent. So, listen, I want to say from myself and from everyone else that's on the call, I'm sure, huge congratulations for keeping Morocco Swallows up. I know it meant a lot to you. They were bottom of the table, weren't they, when you took over in December? So how are you feeling about what you achieved? What does it mean to you?
Mark, I mean, I did it three times before with Barocca, with Black Leopards and with TTM. But this one was extra special because of the circumstances that I was under, because the club had over-budgeted and basically they'd screwed themselves big time with payments. And players were getting half salaries every month. And I'll give you an instance. The second final game against Cape Town All-Stars on the 11th of June, we were flying to Cape Town on the 10th. And the players wouldn't go on the plane until they got paid. And we lost 2-1. You know, and so we went into the last game on the 15th against Tucks. And it was win or bust. You know, and I said to the players, look, whatever you do, you know, just don't think about the football club. Think about yourselves, you know, because it was important. And we knew we weren't going to win in the way that we wanted to win, but we had to win. So it's basically, it's like, and this is no disrespect to Leighton Orient playing against Man United. It was one of them games. We were Man United. We were playing against Leighton Orient. They wanted it more than we did. But I had to get the players to just play for the futures. We won 1-0. We thoroughly deserved the win. But yeah, it was tough. It was very, very tough. But, you know, it's what I was there to do, saving from relegation.
Yeah.
And again, I'm proud that I did it.
Yeah, and we've got quite a few Reading fans on the call, so let's take you back to your time at Reading. So I'm going to do a little introduction, give people a summary. Most people will will know a lot of this already, of course, but you were signed from Leeds by Mark McGee in the summer of 93. You went on to make more than 100 appearances at left back for Reading over the next 3 years. You scored 5 goals and you were part of the Division Two title winning team in the 93-94 season, of course, and you won the Player of the Season award that season. And then, of course, you were part of the side that went so close to going straight up into the Premiership the following season, actually finished second, but didn't go up automatically because of the restructure.
Yeah.
And we all remember that season very well. And it's fair to say that you really embraced life, not just as a Reading player, but as a Reading resident as well. And we know you have some really good stories to tell about three of your favourite friends in Reading, namely Utopia, Valbonds and Curtin's Farm. So I'm sure we come to that in a bit. And then, of course, you went on to play for a few other clubs, including Kilmarnock. And then you went into management. You've won plenty of trophies. You've kept sides up, including Morocco Swallows. You've done really well in South Africa. So well done again for that. And my first question for you, Dylan, is can you remember and tell us a bit about how your move from Leeds to Reading came about? Because I think Gordon Strachan was involved in some way, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I'd actually spoken to Huddersfield, and I think it was Ian Johnson was the manager. And when I went to meet him, obviously because I'm from Yorkshire, it was kind of an ideal thing to go from maybe 40 miles to train at Huddersfield. So I kept staying at home. But then Gordon Strachan said to me, "Look, Mark McGee wants to speak to you." And I phoned Billy Eyre, who was the Blackpool manager, who I played on loan for 3 months. And Billy Eyre said to me, "Go and speak to him and sign for them." And when I spoke to Colin Lee, when I spoke to Mark McGee and I met Colin Lee, and I met a guy called Martin Diener that used to have the complex at Coombe Park. And I had to phone Huddersfield and tell it was Ian Ross, that I wasn't going to sign. And he wasn't happy because we'd obviously agreed terms and conditions and everything. But I just, when I walked in Coombe Park and I listened to Mark's and Colin's vision for the club, remember, I didn't know anybody at Reading. I didn't know, you know, I've never been to Reading then. But when I went to Coombe Park and I saw the facilities and I listened to Mark and Colin, I thought, yeah, that's the club I'm going to sign. And the thing that a lot of people might not know is when you sign for Reading, you got a signing on fee. And my signing on fee was £10,000. And I'm not a gambler, but I went into Coral and we were 33-1 to get promoted, not win the league. So I don't know what odds we were to win the league. And because I'm not a gambler, I actually fancied them odds because I met Phil Parkinson, I met Andy Gray, I met Kevin Dillon, I met, who else did I meet that day? Well, Scotty Taylor. And I actually liked the vibe and, you know, it was a no-brainer. So I went back and it's one of the best decisions I've ever made. And Gordon Strachan told me I'd spent 4 years at Leeds and never played a handful of games. I couldn't get in the team for Gary Speed, God rest his soul, Tony DiRigo, Jim Beglin. And he said, "Look, you need to go and play." And, you know, if it wasn't for Gordon Strachan and Mark McGee, I wouldn't have come. But I'm glad I did.
And we all know you had your own song at Reading. Can you remind us all of how your song goes?
Dylan Kerr, my lord, Dylan Kerr. Dylan Kerr, my lord, Dylan Kerr. Dylan Kerr, my lord, Dylan Kerr. Oh, Lord, Dylan Kerr. I can't do it with both hands because I'm old.
Yeah, there you go. Well, look, Dylan, I'm going to bring in some of the fans now because we've got quite a few fans who want to ask you some questions. And we're going to start with Eunan Carr, who I know back from Reading College days. So that's a very long time ago. Eunan looks pretty much the same. And he's actually got hair. I haven't. But his hair was a bit darker back in those days. But Union's got two questions for you. So, Union, what's your first question for Dylan, please?
Hi, Dylan. You all right? I'm good, my friend. How are you?
Yeah, very good, thank you. So just a quick question around you winning Player of the Season 93-94, because you kind of won that, beating some homegrown people like Edie Williams, Scott Taylor, Stuart Lovell, Jimmy Quinn scored all those goals. So, yeah, it's just about your feelings around that. And who was your, you know, player of your time at the club over those two seasons? Who would you say was player of that period?
Well, the first thing is, like, Quinny hates me. Quinny should have... Yeah, Quinny should have... You know,
yeah.
We wouldn't have got promoted. But remember, well, a lot of people, unless you've listened to Mark's podcast, Quinny did something in training that was like, you know, with Scotty Taylor.
Yeah.
We actually had a meeting, you know, because the Mark McGee and Colin Lee wanted him out of the club, you know, and it was Kevin Dillon that said, look, we actually need him. You know, it doesn't matter what he did. You know, it was wrong. I mean, listen, to be fair, everybody wanted to kick Scotty Taylor because he was annoying. You know, but that one day when he nutmegged Quinny and turned around and laughed at him, Quinny weren't going to take that. I mean, he's an experienced pro. Scotty was a young boy. But Quinny, sorry about that noise in the garden. Quinny should have got the player of the year, but you know, I actually, to be fair, everything came down the left-hand side with me, Jiltsy, and Archie Lovell and Quinny would score the goals. So it was a great honour to be voted player of the year. But Quinny deserved it just because of his goal ratio. I mean, he was a great finisher.
Yeah.
From your second question, now I can't pick anybody out because everybody at that football club did a job for the football club. And because of the way we were as a family, you can't say, well, Archie Lovell did this and James Lambert didn't play much, but he was part of the squad.
Yeah.
Ray Robinson, Andy Williams, you know, Jeff Hopkins, Keith McPherson. I mean, I can tell you, we were a unit. We were characters. And that's what made it so special at Reading.
Yeah.
All right, Una, we're going to move on now to... You've got another question later on, and obviously your son, if he makes it as well. Next up, we've got Roger Ware, who's been a Reading fan for almost 72 years, I think, isn't it, Roger? What's your question for Dylan? And remember to turn your mute on, off, rather.
There you go. Turn the mic on, that's better. Dylan, hi. Listen, done a bit of homework today, and looking down, I didn't realise you were actually born in Malta. It says here in Wikipedia. Did you ever think about playing for them? Because Dennis Allen, back in the 60s, did just that. He was a Reading player, found out he could have played for Malta by birth, and did just that. He played for Malta.
Well, Roger, thank you. Listen, it's good to see you, pal. I actually got asked when I was at Leeds United, but the coach at the time was German and he didn't like English players. He didn't think British players were any good. And it never materialised because of that situation. So I did get asked to play by the Federation, but then I was told that the German coach wasn't interested in English players. So it kind of like never happened, but I wish, no regrets. I don't live regrets, so it never happened. So I don't know what could have been.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been nice, I guess, to play international football, wouldn't it? And you'd think that they're not overburdened for class players there either.
No, but I mean, it was like, you know, look, coaches have different, you know, they work with different personalities and different players. You know, I remember in 2010, obviously I was in South Africa in 2010, and I was David Pleat was living in one of my best friends from Scotland, and he said, David Pleat said, I wanted to sign Dylan, you know, because he's got probably the sweetest left foot he knew about, but it just never materialized. And you know, when he was at Tottenham, imagine, you know, what might have happened if I'd have gone there. But it never happened. And yes, when you play international football, it's always a pleasure. It's always amazing. But, you know, whether I always wanted to play for England, Malta was an opportunity, but it just never happened. And it came from the coach because he was German. And, you know,
yeah,
his choice.
We spoke about that on the podcast, didn't we, Dylan? I remember that. And, yeah, it's a shame in a way, isn't it? But obviously life deals you different hands and it's down to chance and circumstance. I've got another fan to bring in now, Steve Rocker. What's your question for Dylan, Steve?
Okay, I'm obviously going to be asking you about... Hi, Dylan, sorry.
Steve, late the third. I'll let you put the jersey on.
Of course, yeah. My question is 93-94, and it's to do with, I think it was the last game of the season down at Bournemouth. Like most people, I went down there, and the performance, I've got to say, was interesting, to say the least. And I think you were all still legless on the pitch. Is that true? What can you tell me about it?
No, but I'll be honestly, we weren't. We obviously it was Quinny. Me and Quinny had a big fight in the dressing room because I actually cost the game.
All right.
You know, and Quinny's never forgiven me with that because, you know, I like to play football. I didn't like to kick it down the line, and I didn't want to just boot it up the field. And I remember played Jilts. And he got cut out and they scored. And Quinny's never forgiven me for that because it was Quinny's former club. Quinny wanted to... Yeah, don't remind me. But it happened. I mean, but you think sometimes when in that situation, you know, you always did what you thought Jiltsy did. Jiltsy used to run by. He just used to run. I used to play Jiltsy in behind the fullbacks. But this time, he didn't. He stayed wide. He didn't run behind. Mm. So I decided to play. See, he got put out, and we lost the game. And it was my fault. And collectively, it wasn't my fault because we were all in it together. But we went there to win the game, you know. And Quinny went there to win the game. But unfortunately, I fucked up. But I didn't fuck up really. It was just the way that we played. But we were fine. We went there to win the game. It was just one of those games. But we'd won the league. You know, we were already promoted. So
yeah.
it did matter, but it didn't matter. The only person it mattered to was Quinny. You know, and I understand why, because they released him and he wanted something to prove. And still to this day, he always reminds me of that, which, you know.
I think I'm going to go back to Steve's question. He actually wanted to know if the players were still a bit legless from celebrating. I think that was
No, we weren't.
Okay.
We were fine. We were still going to do the same thing. We still wanted to win the game, you know. And yeah. You know, when you look back at it, Steve, we played the way we played the whole season. Remember, back in the day, there was no mobile phones, there was no CCTV, we did things that you could not imagine, and we played, and we won games. So that one game, we still did the same thing we did week in, week out. And I remember Simon Osborne in one of the podcasts said, you know, when we went to Lanzarote, Quinny and Jordy changed that. And maybe that didn't get us promoted that year when we went to the Bolton.
Yeah.
So we were all committed. We were always committed. It was just one of those things.
I think, Dylan, I'm going to predict that you'll get at least one question about the Bolton game. I was at that game. I'm sure one or two others on the call were. But I'm going to come to Andy Lawrence now. Andy, what's your question for Dylan?
Hello, Dylan.
Andy.
My question is, what is your biggest achievement and why?
In football?
Yes.
Winning my first championship medal with Reading as a player. And that's not because I'm here. That's the truth. I was at Leeds United and I only played a bit part in their Division 1 promotion and the Division 2 promotion and the Division 1, the now Premier League championship. But I'd only played a bit part, even though people don't understand you were there. You were part of the squad. You were the one that drove the club to be successful. But the biggest achievement, and this is, and I say, this is not because I'm on the Reading podcast or Reading question and answers. Reading, it was that championship medal meant the world to me. That meant that promotion team meant the world to me, and it still does. And I'm still talking to all the players every single week. I still, social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, I'm still in contact with probably 80% of the players. And Jeff Hopkins messaged me yesterday and he said, fantastic, you've kept your team up. And that's like, what, 25, 27 years ago?
Yeah. And we thanks for your question there, Andy. Good question. And we've got Stuart now. Stuart knows Dylan very well, so this could be an interesting question. What's your question, Stuart?
Oh, firstly, I would just like to say that he says exactly the same thing to the Kilmarnock supporters when they ask him what his greatest achievement up here. So don't buy into that whatsoever. It's all Scottish Cup up here, unless he's just taking the piss out of us. I didn't really have a question, but my interest was piqued when you said that you walked into bookies with 10 grand. How much did you bet on you getting promoted that year?
I shit myself.
Yeah, dobber.
I didn't know the club, Mauler. I didn't know what Reading Football Club were. I knew what Mark McGee had promised. I knew what Billy Eyre had told me, that Reading have got a very, very good chance. Now, imagine 33-1. You know, and you don't know what the makeup is of the team is.
But you didn't even put a tenner on.
No, didn't even put a tenner. Didn't even put a tenner on. I was like, I got 10 grand. I got 10 grand signing on fee. And
how long did that last you? What was that, a good week? Was that a good weekend in Reading, about 10 grand, was it?
No, there was only two pubs in Reading and there's one nightclub. And that didn't open until like later that year.
With the 10 grand that you invested.
No, the nightclub.
Ah, yeah. So, serious question for the guy. Who was the best, when you in that league-winning year, who was the best player you played against that year?
Crikey, that's a good question. Played against? Mauler, that's the worst question you can ask. I mean, it's like, you know, 1995.
Trust me, with what we've been through, that's not the worst question I could ask.
No.
Oh, he's frozen. He's chucked it. He's gone. Look at that.
He's done that on purpose.
His bottle's crashed there completely.
Hopefully he'll come back. We had this a few times in South Africa and he said it was because of power cuts and things like that, but it's the same thing. He didn't like your question, did he?
No, he didn't. It's because he's still using a BlackBerry from 1995 that you're not getting a good connection. It's got
to be what he spent the 10 grand on.
Yeah, it is. It's his BlackBerry.
It's my BlackBerry.
All right. We thought we'd lost you there, Dylan. Glad you're back. Well, look, thanks for that, Stuart.
On you go. Thank you.
We'll come back to you later because I'm sure you've got a bit more insight into Dylan. Dylan, we've got a question for you now from David Andrews. David, what's your question for Dylan, please?
Hi, Dylan, mate. How you doing?
Hello, David. I'm good, sir. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's nice to finally talk to you rather than on Facebook.
Well,
that's
good.
Anyway, when I was growing up, I always remember your goal against Stoke City at Elm Park, that curler right in the top corner. Is that your favourite ever goal you've scored, or have you got any others that you would class as your favourite goal in the famous blue and white hoops?
Well, my first one was Plymouth, right? Remember, I was playing right back. And, you know, that was special because that's when I did that celebration, right? You know, so, and I don't know why I did that celebration. I'm just like, that was my first premier professional league goal. You know, it doesn't matter what league it was in. That was my first professional league goal.
The Stoke City one was just... I actually, if you look back and you listen to it on YouTube, I did a bad one too with Archie. And all the crowd were going, boo. And then Parky mullered the kid. He broke to me again and I played the 1-2 with Archie and I just smacked it in the top corner. But then I got the free kick at Norwich, the free kick at Sunderland. And they're all special because they all had a different meaning. They all had a different, you know, perspective. It's every single goal I scored at Reading mattered.
All right. Well, thanks for your question, David. I remember, and anyone who hasn't seen that goal, it is available on YouTube and it is pretty much as described. So it's worth watching if you haven't seen it. So I'm going to come now to my 1871 co-host, Johnny Hunt. Johnny, have you got a question for Dylan?
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm good, my little that Irish friend. How are you?
Good, mate. Can I borrow your hair dye, first of all?
Listen, this is real. It's no dye. You hair dye. You need hair.
True. Listen, mate, congratulations on staying up again. Absolutely brilliant job.
Thank you very much. Honestly, Johnny, I wish I could write a book on the problems that I have to deal with to do this. But, you know...
What, pulling your hair?
Yeah, no, not pulling my hair. Keeping people in the team. My hair's natural, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Listen, mate, I'll ask you this question because I think we'll get on. When you played for us back in the days, who was the one player that you went, oh, they should have done better, went on to have had a better career from our team?
Scotty Taylor, James Lambert, Lee Barkas, unfortunately got injured. Archie, obviously, from a youngster point of view. And, yeah, them four. You know, it was... I mean, James Lambert was propelled into football
at
age, and everybody, the expectation was very high. Archie was just a Jimmy Quinn but shorter version. Lee Barkas, when I joined, he was probably one of the best influential midfielders, but he had a back problem that never got fixed, and you know he's. Ozzy went to... Simon Osborne was a dream to play with. I love Ozzy. Mm. Kevin Dillon was arrogant, ignorant, but what a player. Parky was a gem. Mickey Gooding was just like on a different level. But the young players that didn't have that opportunity... Scotty Taylor was a dream. You know, he was annoying. He was an annoying team, but what a player.
Yeah.
And he obviously went to Wolves. I think was it Wolves? Yes,
Leicester.
And it never happened for him. But he went there because he Scotty could just do things that, you know, right wingers. He reminded me of an older Steve Coppell, a younger Gordon Hill, and he could do things with the ball that, you know. It was just so basic, knocking them and cross the ball. But Phil Parkinson, I think he was the diamond in the team. Everything worked for Parky, you know. And it was just, like I said, it was a pleasure to work with these players. You know, we were all nobodies. We were all Joe Average. There were no big hitters in there. I think Quinny was probably the most recognised player in the squad and in the team. And everybody else was just a wee bit part player. But we came together and we became, you know, a very, very, very good squad of players. Shaka. I mean, who would have imagined Shaka Hislop coming from Trinidad Tobago being a keeper that went on to win the Freedom of Newcastle last month. What the fuck? Shaka Hislop. Hey, I'm waiting for my call from the mayor of Reading.
Well, or Kilmarnock, maybe.
No, got no chance of Kilmarnock.
Or Marlborough.
Marlon's got more chance of getting freedom of Kilmarnock.
All right. Well, thanks for your question, Johnny. Good to
see
you again. Now, we've got James Earnshaw from the Reading Chronicle on the call. So, your question, James. I imagine there's a chance of a headline out of this one, but over to you.
You all right, Dylan?
Hey, James. No, thanks for your reply, by the way.
Nah, don't worry. So, obviously, you've alluded to sort of the issues that you've had to deal with as a manager. So, what attracts managers to jobs? And sort of what attracted you to your last job?
I love my job. You know, my life's been around football since I was 12 years old, and being told you're not good enough and being told you'll never, ever be a footballer. And when I went to Scotland and played for Kilmarnock and I applied for jobs at the SFA, and Stuart Moore will you know, recognise this. You know, I was never good enough. I was never good enough for the Scottish FA until I got an opportunity to go to Argyll and Bute. Now, Argyll and Bute is the nearest town is probably an hour and a half away from the nearest village. And I only got the job because I was the only one that would do that. I was single, and I wanted to impress the Scottish FA. And I was there for 4 years, and I'm telling the truth now, it's the best job I've ever done. The people I met, the people in Auburn, Tyree, Collinsay, Cole, Tinnabruick, Mull, Tobermory. I mean, I can go all around the Scottish islands of Argyll and Bute and Helensburgh and Dunoon, Campbelltown. I mean, it used to take me 5 hours to drive from Troon to get a boat to drive all the way around to Campbelltown. And that's why I invited Stuart Moore to do it, because, you know, he was a good guy to get involved with that.
No, I was just closer, I think you'll find. I just got closer.
Not really. You were about an hour away, to be fair. I mean, we stayed at a bed and breakfast. And sorry, James, we'll go through a story. We stayed at a bed and breakfast. I mean, it was amazing. I've never met Mawler in my life. I said, Mawler, come on to Campbelltown. Let's go and have a Tynabruick. Mawler, come on. James, sorry, we've got to tell this story at Tynabruick. Tynabruick is right on the Kyles of Bute. And it's on, is it a Clyde?
I don't know if that's the Clyde. I don't think that's the Clyde. I think it's too far from the Clyde.
Tynabruick, from Dunoon, you have to travel about an hour. You know, and it's up and down. I mean, it's the most amazing village on the Loch. And we did a training session. Molly, go on, I'll let you can tell the story. This is brilliant. This is brilliant.
Honestly, it's the tiniest wee village ever. And the only facility they had was a shinty pitch, which was huge. But it was on an angle. It was on a wee hill. And it had been pissing down, raining. And I'd been there all week, and Dylan just appears for the glory at the end. And all week they've been saying to me, can we jump in the puddles? Can we jump in the puddles? And I'm like, no, you're not going anywhere near the puddles because your parents will kill me. I've gone in for a pee, and I've come back, and he is encouraging them now to do diving headers while they are skidding through four puddles and trying to head the ball, having the time of their life. I said to him, have you even checked if there's any stones in that water? He's like, no, we don't do that. But I swear to God, the kids had the time of their life, and they ripped the piss out of me the next day, because I'd said for 4 days, you're not allowed to do this. The big man's like, yeah, get in the puddles. Whoa, ahead of this ball. So I slaughtered him for years until I looked at the Leeds documentary that he did. And I'm looking at him talking about the Leeds documentary. And was it Howard Wilkinson had done the exact same drill with you guys when you were at Leeds? So yeah, that's just what we did for 4 years. I said one thing and he did the other.
Brilliant. No, it was, but James, it was like, it's something I've always dreamed of and something I've always done. It's something I've always tried to prove people wrong and tried to, you know, never give up. I've never given up. I'm still never going to give up of being the dream of being the Man United manager one day. Oh, for Mawler, Glasgow Rangers. Because if I was a Celtic, he wouldn't talk to me.
All right. Cheers, Dylan.
Thanks for your question, James. So I've got a few questions from fans who were unable to join the call, but they wanted to ask you some questions, James. Alex Blissett, who you know, he says, what was your best ever Reading performance and why? Oh, he's, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Did you hear that?
Yeah. No, sorry, I didn't hear that. What's the question?
What was Alex Blissett says, what was your best Reading performance and why?
Plymouth Argyle away, because I played right back. I was a left back. Remember, we'd signed Ray Wallace on loan and Mark McGee didn't fancy him. And I played right back and I scored my first goal for Reading. That was the best performance. Yeah, that was my best performance.
All right. And then we've also got questions from two more from the Blissett family. So we've got Alfie Blissett. He says, what was the worst tackle you ever received while you were playing for Reading?
I can't remember his name now, but it was Tranmere. Tony, I think it was Tony Tom, Thomas. Terry Tony Thomas. Terry Thomas was the comedian and actor. Tony Thomas or Tony Toms from Tranmere when he ruined my career or tried to ruin my career when I ruptured my hamstring. And the worst thing about that, Mark, I was supposed to sign for Norwich the next day. That was the worst thing, you know, and everything happens for a reason in life. But, you know, if Parky had never passed me that ball back from a short corner, I don't know what might have happened. So, yeah, so that was the worst one. You know, I mean, it was a bad injury, a very bad injury.
And then what about at Leeds? Because I know that David Batty had quite a reputation, didn't he? Did he put any tackles in on you?
My first training session, and I was only there training. I wasn't even on trial. I was there keeping fit because I was supposed to sign for Kaiser Chiefs. I just wanted to keep myself fit over Christmas and New Year. Bats nearly broke me in half. And he said, but that was Dave Batty. He did it to everybody. You know, it was a bad one, but that was Dave Batty. So, you know, I've got a scar down my shin from one of the best players, best midfielders and the hardest tacklers, a.k.a. Billy Bremner and Norman Hunter type of footballers. So I'm quite happy to have that scar on my shin.
And talking of your legs, you've got tattoos to mark all your achievements and your latest one is the Swallows tattoo. Are you able to contort yourself to show us or is that a bit tricky?
Look, are we on video? Hang on.
Yeah, on video.
Right, so hang on, let me get this away from my window light. So these are the ones that I've had. Obviously, there's a Reading one. There's a Reading one.
Yeah, right? The old badge. Yeah.
So, all these are from kind of, you know, obviously this is one, the Swallows one, the latest one. I've got the Leeds one, I've got the Kilmarnock tattoo. I've got the Barocca one. I've now got the DSTV Compact Cup, which I want. There's the Leeds one. My first one in 1986 in Arcadia when I left Sheffield Wednesday. But that one's a beauty. That one's a beauty.
There you go. There it is. That's the one we wanted to see. All right. Well, thanks for that. So Lily Blissett, she wants to know, who was the best right winger you ever played against while you were playing for Reading?
Tony Rougier. He gave me an absolute torrid. And Jimmy Quinn and Mickey Gooding didn't play me after that for about four games. We lost 4-0. But I blame Giltsy because Giltsy wasn't... He was supposed to give me cover. He was supposed to give me support. Giltsy just decided to like hang me to dry. So I'm blaming Giltsy for that, by the way.
All right. And Tony Regia, who obviously played for Reading as well.
Yeah. Oh, he was brilliant, Mark. Brilliant. Yeah. I mean, he absolutely gave me a hiding. But then, like I say, if your left midfielder doesn't give you any support to stop the supply, and you've got a guy that can run like, you know, a whippet, no, you've got no chance.
But he was a guest on the podcast, and obviously we had to ask him about his bizarre own goal where it came off his backside or whatever it was in the playoff final against Walsall, I think, wasn't it? So we asked him about that when he was a guest. I've got another question for you, Dylan, from Sarah James. Sarah says, would you like to be Reading manager one day?
Oh, God, me. I would love to be Reading manager one day, but it'll never happen. It'll never happen.
You know? Why won't it happen? Why won't it ever happen?
I'm not recognised as you know, a success in the UK as I am in Africa. And the other issue is the people that are involved with Reading Football Club actually run Reading Football Club from an agent's point of view. So unless, you know, I'm part of that, you know, picture that Reading have, you know, me and myself, you know, Brian McDermott, Kevin Dillon, you know, even Shaka Hislop would never, Parky would never get an opportunity. And it's the way football is now. It's the way football is now. But I would love to, I would actually walk the length of Africa, swim over the Mediterranean and actually swim up the Thames, stop off at Pang, have a beer and then walk to Reading and, you know, love to do that. But, you know, that's it. That's a dream. And that's maybe I'm never going to give up. I'll never give up that opportunity, that dream. But no, I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately.
Maybe one day. I'm going to come to you now, Eunan. Is Jamie on the call?
Eunan? No, Jamie's not on the call. He's come back from football practice a bit tired and a bit injured. So.
Do you want to ask his question for him then?
He's pissed.
Yeah. The question he sort of asked was about your professional debut, when your very first professional game, what you remember of it, how you prepared for it and that sort of thing.
Is that at Leeds or at Reading?
Your first professional game, so it'd be at Leeds, yeah. So you're a young lad and you got your opportunity and away you go. What was the memories?
I was out pished. I was out drinking. I was. It was against Brighton and Hove Albion at home, and I wasn't in the squad. Remember, there's only a squad of 13.
Yeah.
And as always, on a Friday night, I would go out drinking with my friends. And I remember coming over the bridge in Swinton, and I was walking to a nightclub, and it was in 1988. No, 1989. I'd just signed for Leeds. I'd only been there a month. And my mother was stood on the top of the bridge in a dressing gown and slippers. It was like about 11 o'clock at night. And I'm walking to the nightclub with my friends. And she said, listen, Howard Wilkinson's phoned. You're in the squad tomorrow. And I ran home. I think it was about five miles, maybe a bit more. And I phoned the gaffer up. I phoned Howard up and I'm like, I said, gaffer, I've been at my grandma's and she hasn't got a phone. And he says, listen, you know, you're on the bench tomorrow. And I was like, oh, thank you very much. And I had an absolute great game. A great game. We drew 1-1. I came off the bench. I made my debut. And yeah, it was like me and my mother on the bridge in a dressing gown and slippers was weird. But yeah. I made my debut and I haven't told. I hope Howard Wilkinson never hears this because that was the one.
Has Jamie got a second question that you want to ask on his behalf?
Yeah, there was a second question. How did you go about recovering from your injury? You know, the disappointment that you cope with it and getting through it all.
It was horrible. I mean, I remember when I was on the bench. And at half time, and Quinnis poked his head round the corner, and he went, "That's your move, fuck, to Norwich." And I went, "Excuse me." He said, "Oh, we told you to." Remember, because the previous game we played Norwich, and I scored the free kick. I came off the bench and scored the free kick, and Quinny put his head round the corner and went, "That's fucked your Norwich career up." And I went, "What do you mean?" He says, "Oh, Gary Megson wanted to sign you," and I went, I was just speechless. My leg was like black and blue. But it took me a year to get back into running because I couldn't run. I ruptured the entire hamstring muscle, which was never heard of. The only people that rupture hamstring muscles are American footballers and weightlifters. Mm-hmm. You know? And the the surgeon was Graham, I can't remember his name now, and it was his first ever hamstring reconstruction. But every hamstring reconstruction since then has been a success because of what he did to me. Oh. So it was a very, very tough experience. And I went to Rotherham on trial after I'd left Reading, and then I went to Kilmarnock, and my debut was on the 7th of December against Dundee United, against one of the trickiest midfielders, ex-Reading player Andy McLaren. And after the game, when the whistle was, I was like Pope John Paul. I kissed the ground. It was just like, you know, 18 months of pure hell, you know, because I was told I would never play again.
Yeah. You
know, it was unheard of an hamstring. If you can imagine when you get a chicken, you pull it apart and you go, that was my hamstring. So,
yeah.
Dylan, I've got a question for you about, so you won player of the season, Reading won the title, and then a great season after that, you finished second, but of course it gets to the playoff final. You had the trip to Lanzarote, and then tell us about how you found out that you weren't not only going to be in the team, but you weren't even in the squad for the playoff final against Bolton. How did you find out?
Oh, imagine your childhood dream as a footballer to play at Wembley, you know, and old Wembley, not new Wembley, old Wembley. And I knew I wasn't part of it from the Premier game, Bolton game in the league game when we won 2-1. And when we played in the Tranmere game, both home and away, I wasn't involved. And everybody was suited and booted. It was a great occasion. And I knew I wasn't going to play. I mean, they went from 4-4-2 to 3-5-2 because Quinny and Geordie decided that David Lee was going to be too quick. And they needed Jiltsy to, which was fine. That's a football decision. I don't mind that. But Geordie didn't mention the squad or the team. And then he said to me, you're not playing. You may as well go to the bar and get fished. And I was just like, it's something you'll never forget. And I did. I went to the bar and got absolutely hammered. But the next day, I was probably the biggest supporter of that team, you know, apart from the football fans. I was the biggest fan and I was the biggest supporter of that team on the bench, knowing that I wasn't playing, knowing that I wasn't going to make my probably childhood dream of playing at Wembley Stadium.
Right, so Dylan, these lovely people have now been on this call for more than an hour. So I just wanted to ask you, because they joined early to make sure we're all here for when you arrived. So thanks, everyone, for doing that. Dylan, have you got time for one more question? And if you say yes, I kind of have to let everyone answer. So it'll be another sort of about 10 questions, I think.
Yeah,
you happy? You happy with that?
Yeah, of course.
All right. So, Eunan, yourself and Jamie, do you want to ask one question for yourself and one for Jamie?
Yeah, my question is, like, Dylan, you were playing for Reading between 93 and 96, which is a great era for music. So apart from Come By Ya, the song typifies that era for you and that memory of living in Reading. And I don't know if I can conjure up that sort of Britpop era, but I know you've got a very proud taste in music, which, you know, I'm impressed by. I know Mark and Heaven 17 and all those memories, but it was a bit of a different era then.
It were, but I mean, remember, this is the thing that people have to understand, right? Now you can't do what we used to do back in 93, 94, 95, 96.
Yeah.
We were in Utopia every Tuesday night, and we had an eclectic mix of, and I remember there was the guy that sing Things Can Only Get Better that did an appearance at Utopia, and I always remember that song, you know.
Yeah.
But the one song that resonates with me is You're the Best Thing, you know, by the same guy, you know. And I'm an 80s idiot. I'm an 80s you know, and you know, but them two songs, because he performed at Utopia, and what we did as a team, we went there together. We went to Washington Heights. We went to Valbond. We went together. We went to the casino together. We went to TGI Fridays together. There was nobody. The only people that didn't come were Quinny and Tom Jones, because they lived in Swindon. But everybody else was there, you know. And
yeah.
And we actually gave a lot of people in Reading that like kind of respect, because we were drinking with them, we were talking to them. Nobody ignored them. Nobody were bigger and better than anybody. But in Utopia, you know, that, I think them two songs, for me, you know, obviously, you know, Things Can Only Get Better was bigger than You're the Best Thing, but it was there. D-Ream.
That's it. Stuart, I know, Stuart, you need to go. Do you want to ask your question before you go, or do you have to go now?
No, I need a boost. Just when are you coming home, big man up here? Let me know, and we'll see you. To everybody else, thank you so much for allowing me to be part of this.
Thanks, Stuart. Good to see you.
It's been great listening to all the Reading stories. He was a 70s man, never an 80s man.
Great.
All right. Give us a bell, big Stuart, and I'll see you soon.
I will do, my friend.
Right. Take care, sir. Thank you, everybody. Bye now.
Still punching.
Of course, I'm still punching.
Yeah,
one of us has got to be. One of us has got to be, son. Cheerio now.
Bye. So, Eunan, do you want to ask Jamie's next question?
There's another one from me, I think. I went to see you play for Kilmarnock because my grandmother was in care up there. And Jim McIntyre played with you, and he came down to Reading and he scored that game against Motherwell. But yeah, I stood on the stand. It's very similar to South Bank. You know, I don't know if it's the East or West, but it was very similar atmosphere and types of people. Yeah. But, you know, putting you on the spot, you're always going to say Reading was the best. But, you know, what was the funniest thing you ever heard come out of anyone's mouth in the South Bank or Tarlest End or any of the banter that went on?
Can I swear? You're a cunt.
Yeah, yeah. My son's in the other room, but yeah.
That was it. You're a cunt. You're a ginger cunt. I mean, that was it. But, you know, the thing is, like, you know, when Matt Riley and Jimmy McIntyre went to Reading and Andy McLaren went to Reading, they were good players, you know?
Yeah.
And it didn't work, especially for Matt Riley. It didn't work, but it was the environment, you know, that they'd grown up in, and they'd come from, you know, the Scottish Premiership to the English Championship. It was like a different environment. And had all of them been given the right time? You know, Mark Riley was like Phil Parkinson, a wee bit smaller. Jimmy McIntyre in Scotland was Jimmy Quinn. You know, Andy was Scotty Taylor, Mike Jilts, Michael Jilts. It just didn't happen. You know, that's what happened. Excuse me, that's what happened in football. It's when I came to Reading, I was an unknown. And Mark McGee listened to Gordon Strachan, and I became this, you know, I was fascinated with Elm Park. I was fascinated with Coombe Park.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in awe of all these players like Tom Jones, Kevin Dillon, Ray Ranson, Jeff Hopkins, Keith McPherson, Michael Jilts. They were names. They were when I came, I added that final piece, that jigsaw. Simon Osborne added that final piece to that jigsaw. And we didn't need to change much of it. You know, Mark McGee made the biggest fucking mistake ever.
Absolutely.
But money and, you know, fame and whatever was going through his mind, you know. Yes, Leicester was a big club. Wolves were a big club. He could have actually, if he'd have stayed at Reading, I think he would have probably been at Man United now. You know, without, because him and Alex Ferguson were like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he made that choice. He made the wrong choice, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And it typified when we played Wolves that season that we were the hardest team to get beat in that league that year.
Yeah.
But you know what life's like, and you know what players like, and you know man, you know they want to move on to bigger, better things. But if you're honest, I've learned from Howard Wilkinson. You only go to the best teams if they have the same mentality and the same belief that you do.
Mm-hmm. All right, I've got a question. Yeah. I'm going to try and get through these questions quite a little bit quicker than first time around. So thanks for that, Union. Roger, have you got another question you want to ask Dylan? Roger, are you there?
That's it. Got to unmute it now. Yeah, Dylan, are you going to go back to Africa or are you going to give it a go over here now?
I've tried. I applied for the Dundee job. I applied for the Barnsley job, the Doncaster job. I'm actually speaking to Lofty, Tom Watt, who's a big fan of Cheltenham because he lives in Cheltenham. You know, if they, I'm very, very good friends with the chairman at Bristol Rovers, but they just got promoted, you know, last season. Roger, I don't think I'm going to get that opportunity. I'll never give up. I will never give up. But the you need to be in the system. You need to be in the you need to know an agent that's got a pull with the chairman. That's the problem. That's been the problem with Reading Football Club. It's well known. You know, the chairman and the club don't appoint the managers. The agent appoints the managers because the manager brings the player's agent in. And that's the thing that's wrong with football now. You know, how can a chairman run a club and let somebody else who brings in his own people that fails year in, year out, and they still rely on him to bring the next coach who's going to bring the next bunch of failures and the next bunch of players that are not good enough to wear the Reading jersey or any jersey. It's Howard Wilkinson used to do his due diligence and market the players that he thought that could do a job for him, that could promote his club. And he did it with Sheffield Wednesday and he did it with Leeds United twice. And he made these clubs back to the stature that they deserved. But now it's like a lottery, and it's the same in Africa. It's the same in Africa, you know.
You, Dylan, you've got options elsewhere, haven't you? It's not just in Africa. You've got at least one option somewhere else, I think. If you're happy to sort of say
what it is. Do I stay in professional football or do I go and teach kids in America? You know, that's the option I've got. You know, do I want to be happy at 55 years old and live in Arizona and teach kids? Or do I want to still strive and want to be an English football coach? I always believe in what I've always been taught. Believe in yourself and have no regrets. You know, and that's why I live. I've always been told I'm not good enough. I've always been told I'll never be a footballer. I've always been told by the Scottish FA I will never coach football. And I've proved them wrong, and I'm going to still prove them wrong. But, you know, if the Reading job comes up or any other job comes up, I will still apply, but you've got no chance.
And a question next from Steve. Steve, have you got another question that you'd like to ask Dylan?
Yeah, I want to talk briefly about the centre-backs in our team, Dubček, Darius Dubček, Williams, A.D. Williams, Jeff Hopkins, Keith McPherson.
Yeah.
They're all really, really good top players. Who's the best?
Well, you've got Keith McPherson was the captain, who was always steady. You've got A.D. Williams, who was, you know, always the playing kind. Jeff Hopkins used to kill you. And Darius Dubček was just a dream. You know, Darius Dubček was just a dream. But I'm not going to... I can't... I will never, you know...
Pick.
I will never... You've got to understand, when Quinny and Geordie came to the club, the dynamics changed of the club. You know, and you know, they didn't like players. They didn't like me. You know, I wasn't their player. Darius wasn't their player. You know, Darius Dubček was probably, you know, the most calmest, influential defender when he came to Reading. But then you've got a personality. If the personality clashes with the management, it's very very difficult. My personality clashed with the management, and that's why I never played. You know, because I was outspoken. So was Darius. AD was Keith McPherson was quiet. Jeff Hopkins was the hardest man in football. You know, the first five-a-side pick, Jeff Hopkins. You know, and AD Williams was such a young, inspirational player. You know, he just looked after himself. And obviously, when Ray Ranson came, when I came, and then Andy Burnell came, him and Jeff were vying for the right back spot. Stephen Swales came as kind of a threat to me, and then I knew what happened. When Paul Bowden came, I knew that my time was done. Mm. You know, we all know the Swindon connection. But from a centre back point of view, you know, the Keith McPherson was a dream. He was a leader, you know, and AD Williams, you know, was just a dream young boy to play with. But Darius Jovetic, wow, what a player. What a player. But all four of them.
Absolutely.
All four of them did a job.
And you know, Andy, have you got another question that you want to ask Dylan?
I did have, but I think Roger asked...
Dylan.
I forgot his name now, so sorry. I've had a stroke, so sometimes I just forget. But Roger asked what I was going to ask, if you were going to go back to South Africa or if you were going to stay or if you were going to coach over here. So,
is there anything else that you'd like to ask Dylan about, Andy?
Who was the best manager that you played under?
Howard Wilkinson gave me my inspiration to be a coach. Mark McGee wasn't the best coach, but he was a good manager. Colin Lee was brilliant. Bobby Williams at Kilmarnock was just a player's coach. And, I mean, they all had their little, you know, the little bit of an inspiration between them, but Howard Wilkinson inspired me to become who I became, you know. And but the fact that Gordon Strachan, you know, believed in that I could do a job for Reading Football Club and told Mark McGee to sign me. Mm-hmm. Mike Lewis and I can't remember his name now at Leeds United. Oh God, he's going to kill me. But Mike Lewis and the CEO at Leeds at the time, they were arguing because it was 100,000, it was 50,000, and settled on 75,000. It was a no-brainer. And I said, you know, I could have stayed at home in Yorkshire, but I made the transition to come to Reading. I don't live on regrets, Andy, but the one regret is I met my wife in Reading, and I shouldn't have met my wife in Reading, so...
Yeah, that's for a whole episode, isn't it, Dylan? I think that one. Yeah, there you go. All right, David, have you got a question? David, are you still here?
Sorry, yeah. It's all right, I was trying to unmute myself. I was just going to ask, really, growing up as a youngster, who was your inspiration to become, to sort of go into football and want to be a professional player?
Without being like, you know, obviously my dad, but you know, I was my dad used to take me to Leeds, and I used to watch Leeds, so it was obviously Billy Bremner, it was Pete Lorimer, it was Johnny Giles, and I was in that area because my dad was a Leeds fan. Then I became a Man United fan, so it was Gordon Hill, Steve Coppell, Lou Macari, and then obviously, there was Ronnie Glavin, who used to play for Barnsley when I used to watch Barnsley. A guy called Ian Banks, who had the most amazing right foot you could ever dream. But he played for Barnsley, didn't play for any big team. And I just remember as a young kid watching Charlie George when I was 4 years old and had long ginger hair. My granddad said, you know, you're going to be a football player. And I'm like, why? He says, you look like Charlie George. 1971, I was 4 years old, Leeds versus Arsenal. So, yeah, they were kind of, obviously, the usual George Best and people like that. But, no, it was like the local clubs that I'd like supported. There was a right winger at Rotherham called Tony Towner. And I used to watch him and Doncaster Rovers, Glyn Snodding, Ian Snodding. A centre-forward called Colin Douglas, who actually inspired me to be the person I am, because he used to go out every night, clubbing, drinking, and come to work in his suit and his tie and still play and still train the way he did, you know. And Billy Bremner just used to let him go away because he used to score goals. Every game he scored goals. I never let Reading down as a footballer. I never let Reading down as a football fan. And I'm honoured that I'm doing this programme and I'm doing this podcast because of what Reading fans have given me and I've given them. And I love that. I love that, that I'm back home in Mexborough instead of South Africa having this conversation.
Can I just say one last thing?
Sure.
And you said about the, you know, connection between yourself, the fans, and I want to thank you very much for all you've done for the club and for the fans, but also for providing my brother, who runs the South Bank Royals on Instagram, all the like sort of old memorabilia and that. He was telling me how you provided it, and there's some amazing stuff there. So I thank you for doing that. You're a true gent, and always will be a legend of this football club.
Thank you, but I'm sorting out my life in boxes here, so there's going to be lots more pictures, and I've got all my Reading shirts out today, so I'm going to take loads of pictures, and it's going to be posted. Don't worry, to the South Bank. So no, thank you very much. I love this. You know, this is what football is all about. You know, engaging with the fans. Imagine, you know, Paul Pogba doing this. Not a chance.
I would rather speak to you, Dylan. Johnny, have you got another question? Dylan,
if you mate, I could talk to Dylan all night. Mate, you're an absolute star. You really are. You know that. Like you know me about. You've been so supportive about mental health and football over the last few years. Like what advice would you give as a coach, player, to anyone to look out for themselves? You know, you've been through the mill as a coach. Players go through the mill. Contracts, no contracts. What would you say?
Talk to people. Talk to people. You know, the worst thing in life is, you know, being alone. I've been alone since 2002. You know, I sacrificed my life for football. And sometimes you have the highs. A lot of times you have the lows. But you have to talk to people. You have to speak to people. You have to, I mean, I just recently read that Joy Beacham committed suicide. I mean, yeah, you know, yesterday I found out the lady that rents my mum's house, my mum's house, she was 28 years old and she topped herself 2 weeks ago. I didn't know the lady. I was there this morning at my mum's house and I felt an emptiness. But my next door neighbour, who I've known for like 40 years, I just spoke to him. It's about talking. It's about not hiding behind a veil that thinks that you've got problems and you can't discuss it. You know, you can't talk about it. And going out and meeting people and trying to relate to people is very, very difficult now because nobody understands what you're going through. But if you don't tell people, you know, how are you going to get help? And I was in the township last week with 60, 70, 80-year-old people that haven't got an issue in life. And you Johnny, you want to see where they live.
I saw the pictures, mate. Unbelievable. You're a star.
That's a nice bit. That's the nice bit. It's the bar. But they've still got outside toilets. There's still 20 people to a garage that live in Utah. And they've got issues that you wouldn't imagine, but they talk. They don't hide everything.
Yeah.
So,
is that a culture thing, Dylan? Do you think, like, in a different culture, different world?
They've got nothing. They've never had nothing, so they never expect anything. You know, they just deal with life. But the enormity of how people are presumed to be, you know, everything's got something, you know, that's successful, something that's, you know, an adventure. But they haven't, you know. I speak to a lot of people, especially young kids. I mean, there's 37 million under 18-year-old, 19-year-old, 20-year-old unemployed in South Africa that steal, that do drugs. And I actually go out and say, listen, you know, go and find something. Go and do something. Don't just think, well, let's blame the government. Let's blame life. You know, just go and do something. But I engage with them, Johnny. I engage with them.
Right, because you do, mate. You're a star.
They need that.
Change, mate, really. You do. You're so genuine. It really means the world to a lot of people. Thank you.
Like I said, John, it's like, you know, for the past 3 years, I live with myself. You know, I do like a drink. I do like a beer. I'm not an alcoholic. I just like to watch football with a beer. I'm a self person. I don't have to socialize when I'm doing my job. But when I'm at my job, I need people around me. So I can talk, so I can engage, so I can, you know, feel a sense of I'm being one of them, being a part of them, you know, and they've got bigger issues than me. And it's not about money, it's not about fame, it's not about, it's about life. Mm. It's about, you know, I met one of my best friend's sons today. I haven't seen him for like maybe 8 years. His father hung himself. Because he didn't want to talk about it. He didn't want to talk about his anguish. He didn't want to, and he thought the best way to escape was to hang himself. And he did it. And the worst thing is, the tree that he did it on, we can still see the marks that he was trying to get out. Yeah. He knew what he wanted to do, but when he did it, the marks on his feet and his fingers. But it was too late. He couldn't do it, you know. And that's something I have to carry on me, because he knew I was coming back to England. But because I wanted to surprise my mother, I never told him.
Yeah.
So in that, if I told him 2 weeks before, he would have still been here. But I was being selfish because I wanted to surprise my mum. I'd not seen my mum in 4 years. And my mum...
It's not your fault though, mate, as well. Don't carry the blame.
No, I don't. But I remember, Johnny, I remember he sent me an email, and I was coming back from Vietnam, and he says, oh, I want to come over and see you. And I said, yeah, listen, I'm going to come home in the next couple of weeks. And I knew I was coming home. But I didn't, because he's got a gob. He would have told my mother. You know, it was a no-brainer. And because I knew him, I couldn't tell him. And he says, I miss you, buddy. I'm trying to blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to tell him, but I didn't. And then 2 weeks later, he did what he did.
You couldn't have known. No. Presumably, Dylan, you had no idea he was thinking like that.
No, I didn't. And no.
That's the problem, isn't it? We don't know. We just don't know.
All right.
Johnny, I know we're going on, and I'm going to tell you, his son told me today the scenario, right? His son was 15, right? And he went from Mexborough to Swinton with his son, right? So they went 1, 2, 3, 4 pubs, right? He said, I'm going home now, but I've got to go and see my young boy. He just had a kid. He went home and his son said, good night, Dad. I'll see you tomorrow. He didn't go to his son. He went home. And he put a belt round the back of the door. And he hung himself, right? And the next day when he went to see his dad, he couldn't get in the door. So, and he couldn't phone him. And imagine a 16-year-old kid seeing his dad, you know, and it's like, and he, I mean, 10 years later, he's still cut up about it. You know, you can see it in his eyes, and he's asked, you've got to move on. Your dad didn't do that, you know, for you. He did it for himself, you know, and I still feel part of that because I should have told him what's coming home. Whether he made a blind different difference, I don't know. But you've got to talk to people. You've got to go out and say, listen, I'm struggling. And don't tell your best friend because they will just bullshit you. They'll say this. Tell somebody that can give you an objective opinion. Tell somebody that will be honest with you and say, listen, no, don't do that. There's bigger and better, you know. Yeah. But that's me. That's how I see it. No.
Yeah, thanks, Dylan. Thanks for that. I've got one more person on the call. If you're still here, James, have you got another question?
Yeah, my question seems a bit daft after that sort of deep conversation. But if you could relive sort of any sort of 90 minutes in a game, what one would you choose to relive?
When Quinny put that goal in, what goal did we win the league against? Can't remember now. When he headed it in the top corner, when I scored against Plymouth Argyle, when Quinny scored that and all the fans came on,
yeah.
When I made my debut against Huddersfield Town, who I should have signed for, and we beat them 3-0, and Steve Francis was in goal, you know, when Mickey Gooding, you know, went through. I'm trying to think. He's the midfielder at Millwall when he got sent off because I played the wrong pass to him. There were so many games that you just have a thought about, you know, and that's what cares about Reading Football Club at the time. You know, we were never under scrutiny. We had a gift of enjoying football, and that's what Reading Football Club need to do now: enjoy football. You know that you've got a chairman that spent billions on Reading Football Club. He needs to take ownership of Reading Football Club and bring back that kind of spirit.
All right, Dylan, because your alarm's just gone off, what I'm going to do, and thanks for your question, James. I've got a few more questions, so a couple of fans want to ask you some questions, but we're going to do it like a quick fire thing. So just think of what comes off the top of your head, and we'll go from there. So Sarah would like to know, she just said, could I ask you something about Mark McGee? So you talked a little bit about him as a manager, and you said he was a good man manager. What was it that made him a good man manager?
He let Colin Lee do the training, you know, and he looked after the players. But he was always the last pick in the five-a-side because nobody wanted to pick him. But they called him Shinner because every time he took a touch, he came off his shin and he went to the opposition. So he liked his five-a-side, but he was always the last pick. But he was a good man manager. He was brought up by Alex Ferguson, and you know, you can either be a coach or a manager. And he was a good man manager. He pointed fingers. He pointed fingers and he told you what he thought.
All right. Next question is another question from Alex. He wants to know which Reading player was the best dancer at Utopia?
Oh, God. Me?
I thought you might say that.
Me? Right. Uwe Artenberger thought he was a good dancer, but he went to King Cross and danced. Uwe Artenberger, every week, three times a week, was in King's Cross. I don't know why. Well, I do know why, but I can't go into that. Right. But yeah, me. I was the best dancer in Utah.
Fair enough. Chelsea
claims that he could dance, but no.
Nah. Right. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about Utopia, but you've kind of covered that. That was every Tuesday night, wasn't it? And we know you enjoyed yourself there. But I want to kind of finish off by asking you, actually, you mentioned about some of the experiences with other people, you know, but actually, you, during your time at Reading, you had a really nasty car accident. And in some ways, you were lucky to survive it, weren't you? Can you tell us about that?
That's when I met my wife, and I ended up marrying my wife. We won a game, and I went to Bracknell to meet Aidy Williams, Scotty Taylor, and I think Archie was there that night. And then I went home and I met this girl the previous night in Sindelsham Mill. Sorry, the previous week in Sindelsham Mill, and I agreed to meet her. And then when I got back to Curtin's Farm, she phoned me up and said, look, I want to come and stay at Curtin's Farm. And I drove home. I drove from Curtin's Farm to Mortimer, which is in the country lanes. And when I drove back, a car came up and I lost control and I hit the car. And luckily, I didn't hit it head on. If I'd have hit it head on, we wouldn't be having this conversation now. We'd have both been dead. And, you know, I did it for one reason. And that reason was, you know, to be with a girl that I shouldn't have been with. And I ended up marrying her, you know. So I was very, very fortunate. We both survived. But it taught me a good life lesson, you know. Don't do it. Don't let that think apart from that thing. So any regrets? No regrets, but one regret, don't drink and drive. Never drink and drive.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks, Dylan. I was going to ask you about what are your plans now, but I think Roger asked a question earlier, so we've heard a little bit about that. But what else do you want to say? Was there anything that you wanted to talk about that you haven't talked about? Is there anything that you want to say to the Reading fans to finish up with?
I'm absolutely, you know, astounded by this. I just, you know, there's so many platforms that you're not able to talk about, you know, the life that we had as kind of just average players. We were honest. We were real players. The beauty of when I signed for Reading, we went to the White Horse in Pangbourne, and I always remember I'd only been there like 2 weeks, and it was like pre-season. And the rule was nobody left. And we went there from 11 o'clock. And I think we left at probably 11 o'clock because the pub shut at 11 back in the day. And we all stayed. And that's when I knew that this club was going to win the league. You know, and people don't know this. You know, Shaki Hislop never drank and he got absolutely steamed out of his head. And he loved it. And he became, you know, Shaq Aislaw. Kevin Dillon, he lived in Pangbourne. He lived on Coombe Estate. And he only had to walk home. Mickey Gooding, the same. Drank at Pangbourne Workingmen's Club. We had a connection of honest, genuine, hardworking people. Tom Jones couldn't get in the team because of Kevin Dillon and Phil Parkinson. You know, it was like Michael Jiltz was Michael Jiltz. Me and Jiltz had such a good relationship. Even the best Premier League teams now, you know, they haven't got that. You know, they haven't got that. And it's kind of like everybody's now an individual. You know, there's not that, you know, connection that we had at Reading. And I made a big decision to leave Yorkshire to go down to Berkshire. And it was the best decision I ever made. The injury kind of fucked up my career because, you know, had I known that I was going to sign for Norwich, I wouldn't have played that game against Tranmere. And who knows where I'd have gone. I might not be sat here. I'm in this conversation now. You know, I wouldn't have been in South Africa because I wouldn't have had this conversation now. Because, it, you know, life is swings and roundabouts, as they say in Scotland. But them 2 years at Reading Football Club, and I'm not saying this because I'm on this. They made me as a person, they made me as a player, and they made me as a supporter of the football club. You know, and like I said, I'm honoured, I'm blessed that I'm actually doing this. I mean, Mark, when you suggested this, I'm like, wow. You know, this is even the podcast that we've been doing. It's all about genuine nativity, and it's all about honesty, you know. And what I'm saying is, it's not bullshit; it's the truth. And people need to know that, because without fans, football's not football.
All right, Dylan. Well, I just want to say a massive thank you for joining us. Congratulations again. Long may your success continue. But we all really appreciate you being on this. And thanks to everyone who's joined the call. So, great to have you on us on with us. And hope you all enjoyed it. And Dylan, hope you enjoyed it as well.
Mark, can I ask you, right, Roger's there looking very pensive. Roger, what was your memory of them 2-3 years what made you think, well, this is a good team?
I come from an era, as Mark said early on in the show, first watched them in 1950, watched the team. And through the years, I was on the Chronicle for 12 years, and during that time we never went anywhere. We went down a couple of times, up once, and that was about it. Never did anything. And it was only really about the late 80s and then where you were there, mid 90s, that the club really began to mean something. And it meant something obviously along the way to a lot of people, but it was at that time that the club, you thought, well, yeah, maybe they are going to go somewhere now. And certainly the Wembley thing, that was a real choker for you, I bet, not playing in that. But it was a choker of a game as well, wasn't it? I still get quite angry thinking about that Bolton game, not least because I still think, and I don't know, you were sat on the sidelines. My bugbear about that game was, one, that Jason McAteer didn't get sent off for chopping Gilksy because he'd already been booked and he was running around like a headless chicken that day, McAteer. And also on the... I think it was their fourth goal, De Freitas, and he's hit the post. He's gone on the ground, and I'm absolutely certain he pulled the ball round with his hand and then got up and knocked it in the net. And the only one who appealed, I think, was A.D. Williams. And I think Xhaka later said that he thought it might have been iffy as well. But I thought at the time, I thought he's dragged that round with his arm. All right, I suppose what a choker that day was.
Roger, for me, right, and remember, I was sat on the bench and I was like, I was actually off the bench more than Phil Horner. So I was on the sideline because I was like, I didn't think we were going to lose that game, right? But for me, and I'm doing this as a coach now, for me, when Lee Nogan came off, that killed us, because then Alan Stubbs and Jason McAteer decided that, you know, that them two were the danger. And when Noggs was on, he stopped Stubbsy. And once you stop Stubbsy, Jason McAteer is not involved. Then Quinny came on. Obviously, if Quinny had been playing, he'd have scored that penalty. But when Quinny came on, he didn't track back Stubbsy. So when Stubbsy came into midfield, that dragged everybody in. And that gave Jason McAteer. That's from me sitting on the sidelines, not being pissed off. That was me genuinely being, you know, observant of the game. And it, you know, whatever, you know, if Archie had scored that goal, game over. But, you know, it was like, had Quinny not been on the bench and you had another runner on the bench, then maybe... I think the result, but don't get me wrong, I'm not criticising the decision that they made, but from a football perspective, when Lee Nogan came off, that gave Bolton that opportunity, because Stubbsy didn't do nothing in the first half. Second half, he ran the show. Yeah. He was like a Darius Dovcek that, you know, could play. But that's my opinion, you know.
Yeah.
That's a football.
Andy Bernal got hurt as well, didn't he, I think, as I remember?
Yeah. Yes. But, I mean, it's like the one for me was when Nobbs came off. The car train, and, you know, you just think, well, you know, if he'd have stayed on, Alan Stubbs wouldn't have been in the game. He wasn't. Yeah. But he came out and he brought the game for Bolton. And that gave McAteer and De Freitas and what's the Scottish guy?
Was it Coyle? No.
No.
Was it Owen Coyle?
That's McGinley.
Oh, yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, so he's not Scottish. He coached in Scotland. That's how they came into the game. Whether Archie had missed a penalty or not, without Stubbsy, they wouldn't have won that game. For me. And that's me watching the game as a footballer.
I'm not sure Archie ever recovered from that, did he? I think he probably still relives that now.
I think when they went up to the Premier League, it was a bit of a relief for him, wasn't it? But look, Dylan, yeah. I just want to finish off with this. I just want to say, you know, it's been great to know you all these years. And thanks for doing the two podcasts, because we did the other one with Tom Watt, didn't we, before? And really enjoyed that. Some great people we spoke to there. Just thanks for doing the 1871 podcast. Been great to speak to you. And look, let me know where you are and how long you're here. And I'll, you know, even if I have to come up to Mexborough, I'll come and see you, mate.
Brilliant. Brilliant. No, thank you to everybody that's been on the show. And thank you for you for introducing the football fans to the real Reading FC, you know?
Yeah, thanks, Dylan.
All right. Sports Social Podcast
Network. Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.